Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's Australian Open Round 1 catch-up,
Djokovic is tested like never before by teenage qualifier,
Garcia gets the better of Naomi Osaka,
and Andy Murray plays what could be his final match in Australia.
Chris, today is the 16th of January and we are here to catch up on round one of the Australian Open at Tennis Weekly HQ. A historic round one for that matter, because we had a Sunday start, the first ever Sunday start at the Australian Open. 3 days of round one matches. I am exhausted already, but also a little bit jealous because I know the weather out there has been a little bit extreme at times, but the heat, it does look like an environment I would like to be in when I look outside and it is very, very chilly in London at the moment.
I mean, we have snow in Copenhagen right now. So at the moment, I think it's Wednesday and I'm very confused about the temperature because I'm seeing 31. I'm feeling minus 10.
I mean, Casper Ruud said in an interview it was minus 20 back home. So I feel like he's got the biggest extreme difference to go, I guess, from getting on a plane to the heat of Melbourne.
Indoor tennis only, I think, in Oslo, and then very much outdoor.
Indoor tennis actually, all year round.
Yeah, I mean, it could be too hot in Australia. They might have to close the roof, so it could be indoors wherever he goes.
Well, we're going to be chatting all about round one in this episode. We're also going to be unveiling our collector set player pick predictions as well.
We have good news, Joel, don't we?
I know we do.
We're going to tease that.
We're keeping it under wraps. But yes, we have an opportunity to gloat over Kim. Need I say more? But before we do get into all of that, we do need to talk about, first of all, the fact that it is a historic start. It's a Sunday start, but there's also been some new rules that have been in place at the Australian Open for fans this year. You know, we're a fan podcast at heart. We want to talk about these fan rules that are affecting the crowds in Melbourne Park, and that is that crowds are allowed to enter after each game. So you don't have, there's no waiting around until you know, players sit down and then you can find your seat. You can move after each game, and it's divided opinion, hasn't it?
It has. I think when I kind of first heard it, I thought this can't be real because it seemed to kind of slip under the radar for a lot of us.
Yeah, where was this? This should have been breaking news.
Well, apparently when Stan queried it, it was confirmed that it was in an email that was sent out prior to the tournament. So clearly we're not on that mailing list. But I mean, it is quite shocking because there's not much time, I always think, and that's the reason why they do it, because then there's enough time for fans to get into the stand, find their seat, take their seat, and not interrupt the players or cause a commotion. Because even with some of those rules that are in place where it is only every second game or odd number of games, sometimes you see people who are nowhere near their seats in these big arenas. So personally, I think it doesn't really make sense. I understand you want to get fans onto the court, but I guess you have to have some sort of consistency because it just felt like it was chaos on day one.
Yeah, it's tricky. I know the Australian Open kind of market themselves as like the happy slam, and I do think they do a lot for the fan experience, and maybe this is part of that thinking that they want to give fans you know, as much of an opportunity to get on court and not miss any sort of tennis. But at the same time, I do think they've got to put the players into this thinking as well, and it's been interesting to, as I say, kind of hear some of the opinions out there. I mean, Djokovic, I mean, he you know, in his match, he was kind of a bit annoyed by the noise and the movement of the crowd. And he actually lodged a complaint, you know, with the umpire requesting them to kind of maintain silence during active play. Do you sort of sympathise with the players from that perspective? Or do you think they should be able to just get on with it?
Well, I mean, I'm always kind of a little bit on the side that the players have it a bit too good. I think it's been a while since Djokovic has, you know, been out in the kind of out in the, I guess, in the grounds of slams, because, you know, if you're out on court 5 or 6 at Wimbledon, yeah, I mean, people are constantly streaming past you, and there's no reason to complain. That's just how it is. If you're at the US Open, I mean, it's relentless chatter if you're on a big court, and if you're on an outside court, people can come and go pretty much as they please without kind of the stewards being there. So I think there's probably, when people do complain about these things, there's something else that's bothering them. Because ultimately you should be able to play through these sorts of things, and maybe it's other frustrations kind of bubbling over, such as, you know, Jordan Thompson. I think he said it's the wokest tournament ever.
Yeah, I saw those comments. I was a bit surprised. He's normally quite a measured guy. I thought this came out of completely out of nowhere.
It did seem a bit left field, because obviously, I mean, if his ranking does drop, he might be looking for one of those wild cards from Australian tennis. But I mean, I think they'll see how it goes. I think it's nice that they're kind of having a test of it, but I just think a slam might not be the best place for that. Maybe start at the next gen finals.
And I mean, let's just talk very quickly about the Sunday start. What did you make of it? Because it's great, I guess, in the sense that I actually personally like seeing more tennis on the weekend outside of, you know, working hours. It's great to get kind of fans down. From the tournament organizer point of view, it no doubt makes sense for sponsors and money and finances. But I still think, from a scheduling point of view, we were left in the same situation. Play still went on very, very late. You know, team FAA finished at 01:40 local hours. So it didn't feel like it really did the job that it was there to do in the first place.
Yeah, and it was just kind of that Sabalenka didn't go on until, I think it was 11:30.
Yeah, that's not right for a defending champion, is it?
It doesn't feel right, especially on a Sunday, because, I mean, Sunday still means a working day the next day, so yeah, it's not like it's a Saturday
night.
Who's
watching that? Yeah.
There weren't that many people there, and I think she said she's very appreciative of the people that did stay. I do just think this is Craig Tilley once again at it with the fact he's saying that this is going to be something that will combat these 4:30 a.m. finishes and these kind of crazy finishes that we had over the years. I mean, obviously, there have been some mad ones with Murray last year, and this was welcomed as a positive initiative. But I mean, when you have kind of already such late finishes, sure, they didn't begin with a 4, they begin with a 1. But it is very reliant still on the fact that some of these other matches aren't going long. I mean, Sabalenka got that first set done in something like 22 minutes. And you can't rely on that at these stages of tournaments. And you can't be playing that late from the Sunday start. I mean, if you look at the French, for example, they have a very limited schedule. There was a limited schedule here. So it's clear it's not about kind of spreading the schedule. It's much more about making it more of an event, selling more tickets. And ultimately, that's good for people coming on the Sunday. But if you did have an evening session ticket, you want people to be able to stay and enjoy the evening session. And that kind of defeats the purpose of making it the happy fan slam.
The ATP and WTA have come out with some united rules in the build-up to the Australian Open, talking about the fact that the events on the tour, so not necessarily the Grand Slams, but the events on the tour, they've come out and said there will be no more than 5 matches per day per court with an 11 a.m. start, with 3 matches during the day session and 2 matches during the evening session, as some rules and guidance for tournaments. So it's nice to see that being implemented, you know, taking into account you know, players, and, you know, not having them come on at the most ridiculous times. But I guess it still doesn't really answer, you know, the question for Grand Slams, and it's still like a tricky thing, I think, to manage. But I'm slightly wary that I think the conditions here, the ball that is being used, we have had a lot of 5-setters, haven't we, you know, in round one already. 19 in total have gone to the deciding set. I mean, I feel like it's not just, you know, the scheduling. I think there's other factors at play, and it's the court, it's the atmosphere in terms of the weather, and the balls, I think, are also meaning that, like, matches are just naturally taking a lot longer, I think, to complete.
Yeah, you'd have to think about kind of switching the ball. It's just making an even bigger case for it with the fact that these matches are going so long and there are sort of these matches going on so late. But that's what's good about this new policy from the WTA and ATP, that if a match has not been put onto a court by 10:30, it can be moved to an alternative court. And that's by no later than 11 p.m. So that's something that I think is really good, because what that means is that people are able to still get their matches played And on court. And I think that's the positive thing when you look at this, that at least these matches do get done at the Australian Open. Whereas if this was Wimbledon, there would be a curfew and they'd be coming back tomorrow. So it depends, you know, do you want to lie in the next day? I'm sure they don't lie in, but
I was going to say, I mean, another rule they're bringing in is no matches to go on court after 11 p.m. I don't think the Madrid Open is going to be transformed by this, I swear.
Surely this can't apply because it's different time zones. It's Spanish time. That's different.
Well, I mean, let's move on and talk about all the action we've had over the first 3 days, starting with what we've seen today, day three. On the main courts today, we've had wins for Holger Rune, Carlos Alcaraz, Casper Ruud, Victoria Azarenka, Jesse Pegula, and Grigor Dimitrov. I mean, we had some tough straight sets wins, I would say, for Świątek against Sofia Kenin, who won 7-6, 6-2. And then Rybakina against Pliskova, 7-6, 6-4. Were you impressed with the manner of those victories by Świątek and Rybakina, given the caliber of their opponents?
Yeah, I think getting through a first round against a tricky player is always something you should be very pleased with. I think getting the win is what matters, putting yourself in situations where you can go deeper into the tournament. I think before the tournament, Pegula was asked this question, and she said, well, when you start, you go round by round and you hope to make it a second week. When you make it a second week, you hope to make it further. And I think that's very much how a lot of these players sort of start tournaments. They think with that attitude, you can only play the player in front of you at the start. And then hopefully Iga didn't take too much notice of the draw because it doesn't get much easier in round two with Collins. But I was impressed with Iga coming through that. And I think the nature of when you do get a tight set and then you pull through and keep the momentum, I think that is very positive. And having a test early isn't a bad thing. I think Rybakina got very lucky. She was three set points down in that first set, and it looked like she was probably going to lose that
she
one.
She nicked it. Yeah.
She really did. But I mean, on serve, she did do really well. I mean, she was only broken once. One break point faced was broken once. And she won 77% of points on the second serve and 74% on the first serve. So, I mean, it was a bit of a serving masterclass, really, from her in that sense. And, good for her to get a test. We did see her in Adelaide where she kind of went out quite well without putting up too much of a fight against Alexandrova. So it's good to see that she's brought the same tennis that she played in Brisbane to Melbourne with her.
Exactly. And I mean, on the men's side, we had Alcaraz defeat Gasquet in straight sets. A little bit of rust, I would say, in that first set. Gasquet threatened to take that first set. But yeah, Alcaraz getting it done very comfortably in the end. I mean, a lot of the talk, Chris, has been around Sasha Zverev over the last couple of days. He defeated Dominic Kupfer of Germany in four sets, 4-6, 6-3, 7-6, 6-3. But let's be honest, that match is not really the talking point when it comes to Zverev at the moment, because it's been announced that he's going to be facing a trial during this year's French Open over the lingering domestic abuse allegations that have just kind of been following him forever and ever and ever, it seems. That hearing, we've been told, is going to start on the 31st of May. Zverev doesn't have to be there in person, but yeah, this is not ideal news, I feel, going into the Australian Open if you're, you know, Sasha Zverev, who is on the ATP Player Council as well. And it's just been very fascinating to see, I guess, how players have reacted to it. And everyone in the stadium has been reacting to it as well, because it doesn't feel like anyone is really giving an opinion on it.
Yeah, and I think it's something where this has not been kind of as widely publicised until the last couple of days. I think it's something where even people who I know who are into tennis are shocked when I tell them about the previous accusations that have been made, as well as the fact that kind of a penalty order was given. And this is actually because of a challenge to that, an objection against the order, which means that he is going to a trial, but it does mean he's legally innocent and not convicted until the final ruling. But the fact that it was given, that penalty order, meant that the judge felt there was enough evidence that it didn't need to go to trial. So it's a bit more serious than just kind of innocent until proven guilty in this sense. And I think that something that really is a problem is that when you see Sasha Zverev being put onto the ATP Player Council, and when you ask the players, and the players were asked about this, which I think is perfectly fair, especially in these press conferences, and Grigor Dimitrov, who's also on the Player Council, was asked about this and whether he thought this was kind of the right thing for him to be serving on the Player Council, as he's literally just been elected, but this is after the penalty order. So it is very surprising for a lot of people. Dimitrov said it was the first that he'd heard of it, And there are a lot of similar statements of people who said that, from Tsitsipas, for example, who said he doesn't know the situation, he's unfamiliar and has nothing to comment on, which I think, if you don't want to comment on it because you aren't aware of what's going on, I think that's fine. But I do think they should make it clear that they do very much have a firm stance against domestic abuse in this case. And this is not something that should be taken lightly without having to come down on either sides. And I mean, pretty much everybody on the male side didn't say anything about it. They said they weren't aware of it. Whereas the vulnerable one, Iga Świątek, who we've already talked about, I thought she gave a brilliant answer on this. And she said that there's no kind of good answer to that. I think it's up to the ATP and what they decide. For sure, it's not good when a player who's facing charges like that is kind of being promoted. And I think that's something that we can all agree on, irrespective of what is to come at this point, is that it's not a good look if someone is facing a trial for domestic and physical abuse allegations to be promoted so heavily, and for this not to be part of the narrative that's currently going on, because it feels like it was silenced for a long time, and that now I think people need to consider this when they think of Sasha Zverev.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because, you know, from Zverev's point of view, he was asked about it, and he just kind of point blankly said, why would it not be? He thinks it's completely okay, you know, for him to be on the player council. And I guess, you know, there will be fans out there who probably will say something along the lines of innocent until proven guilty. So he should be able to kind of be on these things. But there's certainly, I think, a balance there. And I think it's interesting to see how, say, the players are giving very limited kind of reactions, that saying they're not aware or whatever it is, when this has been going on so long. It's like, how can you not be kind of aware of it? And say, given his kind of promotion, I think, to the player council, yeah, it's certainly a tricky spot that isn't going anywhere. And it could get even more farcical, I guess, come the French Open. And, you know, he's had very good runs there, you know, previously getting to, you know, semi-finals. It could get even sillier, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's nothing really kind of silly about this. I think it's less about the ATP player council. I think it's more about the fact that someone who has multiple claims against them, there's been no action taken by the ATP. Previously, they said there was insufficient evidence from a separate woman who had claims of physical abuse. And so I think it's a case where they said if there was more things came to light, they would investigate again. And so I think there's a lot of people who are looking at the ATP to come out with something, and I think probably they're going to wait until the result, which I think a lot of people will agree with, some people will disagree with, but I think there'll be some, I mean, it will make it for a very, I mean, interesting, we should say, and we've been using that word a lot, but it will make for a very dramatic and probably highly explosive French Open first week, because he could be summoned to the court as well. There is a chance that could happen as well in the later proceedings, which would be during Wimbledon. So, I mean, there's a lot to come, but right now we have to stress that he is innocent until proven guilty, and he is very much still in the tournament.
Well, back to the tennis, and we had Kokkinakis and Tomjanovic as well. I enjoyed seeing their victories, because Tomjanovic, you know, she pulled out, I feel like, on the eve of the tournament last year. She was 4-1 down against Martic late at night, came through in three sets. And Kokkinakis against Offner won in a final set tiebreak. We all remember him losing that epic to Andy Murray last year. So to him to get a five-set victory at Melbourne, yeah, the emotions, I just can't imagine that they were going through. Another player who would have been going, I think, through the same emotions was Emma Raducanu, who was on the court today against Shelby Rogers. That was a straight sets victory for Raducanu. I feel like both of these players have had long-term injuries to kind of deal with in the past, but Raducanu coming through 6-3, 6-2. Chris, what did you make of the Raducanu return to the Grand Slam stage at the Australian Open and the performance she put in against someone as experienced as Shelby Rogers?
I thought she put in a very assured performance. I thought it was confident. I thought she seemed relaxed out there. I think she did play a little bit within herself. It wasn't the same sort of US Open kind of go for broke tennis where everything she seemed to hit went in. I think it was very, very measured. And I mean, she's got to be happy with that because, you know, it's her first Grand Slam back. She said it definitely does make it a little bit extra sweet. And in the next round, she's got a really good draw. So I think it's...
Yeah, the draw's opening up for her because Castella lost. I mean, we could even potentially have a Battle of the Brits, Bolter versus Raducanu in round three. It's very exciting.
Potentially could be on. But I think in terms of like a performance, I mean, I'm not sure you could ask for much more because, I mean, Shelby Rogers is a good player, but she hasn't played since last year's Wimbledon. So it's almost like a dream first round draw because, I mean, this was her first match back on a tennis court in such a long period of time. Whereas kind of Raducanu has probably been playing a lot more tennis than Shelby has recently. So good to get the win and hard to gauge really, you know, just how high the level can go. But I mean, I think a lot of people are hoping that we'll see her play against, I think it's Qin Wen Zheng, could be potentially an opponent if it isn't Katie Boulter and if she does make it through. But obviously we're looking ahead in the draw. You know, when we do that,
we're too excited. We should know that with Raducanu, you just got to take it one match at a time. But it was a very, very, very good performance. Another Brit who put in a very good performance was Jack Draper, who won his first ever five-set match against Marcos Giron of the United States. Chris, this was a wild ride. Ended in him vomiting into a bin. Very, very, very classy.
Is that a technical term? Vomiting.
vomiting into a bin. He had to do the handshake very, very quickly and then went to a bin on the side of the court because he wasn't feeling great. But a very good victory, I think, for Jack Draper, given all the exertions he had to put in the week before. Then coming to this, in the brutal heat of the day, it's got to be said, on the verge of defeat when there's lots of expectation and pressure on you, to pull it out the bag and win in five sets, that was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and I think what I was really impressed by was the fact that he did talk about it being more of the mental struggle, the psychological stress today that was causing fatigue rather than just the physical nature of the match. Because he said he felt better in the fifth set than I did in the first. And you have to think that, I mean,
the set score lines, it looked like, it went to five sets, but the more that match went on, you did feel like Draper was getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah, I mean, he even threw a bagel in that fourth set. But he did go down, he did go down two sets to one. So it's not a two sets to love defeat that he overturned, but it does show a real strength of character and a real sort of shift in him physically. And I think a lot of people were saying, oh, is it a sign that physically he isn't there? And I really don't think it is that because, I mean, if you look at the score line, it's not like he sort of crawled over the finish line there. He actually accelerated towards the finish. And the only question I would have is that I've never seen that many people throw up from psychological stress. I feel like maybe it was the relief of the exertion, but either way, I think it's great that he got through. And a lot of people thought, you know, on the back of having such a good and deep run last week, that maybe this would mean a first round or early exit. So, I mean, getting a win is a big relief.
That image at the end, as I say, I think to me that was like, this is why you shouldn't play the tournament the week before a Grand Slam.
You think that's what happens? Inevitable. Well, you saw it coming.
I just think you're almost like tempting fate, and regardless of, you know, it might be seen as an easier opportunity to win your first tour title. If you harbour hopes and ambitions of going deep in a Grand Slam, I'm not sure with
your rankings
the
important
week
though. You know, you got to get the ranking points, get yourself into some of those
so
higher
much to
tournaments.
Factor in.
And also, you don't know how you're going to do, and that's why I think we've seen so many of the top players, if they do play, then they do withdraw, or they do, as I've said multiple times, Rebecca, where she just didn't turn up and just hopped on a plane. But in terms of this result for Jack, you have to think that, I mean, he's going to be aiming to have a deep run here, despite that, very much. And then also looking towards the rest of the season, I mean, he's really come out firing, making the final of his last two tournaments he's played and getting a win down under. If he can recover both physically and mentally before his next round, I mean, he's got the firepower that he can potentially make matches short if he's playing well, and maybe we'll see him kind of go even more aggressive because that's what he needs to do if he's not
feeling...
Will
we have the bin next to his chair in the next match as opposed to on
the
side?
I just feel bad.
Is it going to be preemptive now?
I just feel bad because, you know, this is should be like Jack fights back. Instead, it's Jack throws up in bin and you're like...
It happens, you know, it happens to everyone. And I remember watching Andy
Murray. Sinner did it last year.
Yes, Yannick Sinner. And I remember Andy Murray going through his formative ages. And
it's a mark of a champion.
Yeah, against, I think it was Andre Pavel at the US Open. I remember watching it at like 3 a.m. in my family home. And he did it during the match, and the camera had to quickly kind of cut away. So it happens to the best. It happens to the best is all
no
I can say.
No one saw Jack. It's okay. It's fine. It's not all across every single media publication out there.
I mean, there were great wins as well for Arthur Fils, Jiří Lehečka. Trevor Sand won.
What about Sloane
as well?
Stephens from the day before? I wanted to bring it up.
Sloane Stephens against Gadecki.
Her first win down under since 2019. And I just thought, amazing.
I was reading some comments on social media around, I think the hotel staff will be surprised she's staying for a few more days.
Yeah, I think people thought that maybe, you know, she only booked it for the first couple of nights and might have to try and get another hotel. But I mean, I'm looking forward to Kasatkina versus Sloane Stephens in the next round. I think there are going to be chances.
Okay, okay. Well, I'll hold you to that, and we'll see how that goes. But Chris, one other player I want to talk about on day three is Sumit Nagal from India. This is just an incredible story. First Indian man in 35 years to beat a seed at a Grand Slam. Incredible result against Alexander Bublik. I mean, it's quite fascinating, actually. Of the 32 seeds at the Australian Open, 30 of them won. Alexander Bublik wasn't one of them. And Nagal is a player who, he's talked about his financial struggles on social media. I mean, he had, I think, you know, he tweeted the fact that he only had 775 quid in his bank account.
That's a bit more than you, Joel. So, what's he complaining about?
Exactly. Earlier than this year, and now, you know, he's just pocketed £95,000, which is incredible. But it's just so great, I think, to see, you know, Tendulkar on social media has thanked him, Bopana as well. This is just a great feel-good story.
Yeah, and I saw him play at the Davis Cup match last February against Denmark here, just outside Copenhagen in Hillerød, and I couldn't really understand why his ranking was where it was. It was very low, but he really played some fantastic tennis against Holger Rune. And I said to Alina at the time that he's one to watch, and we've been following his results ever since. And he really can play tennis. And we talked to Bopana, and he said a lot of it is down to not getting the funding, because there are so many talented players. You look at kind of Yuki Bamri, who obviously had incredible junior success when it relies more on your potential talent ability than just your physical ability and access to training, I would argue. And he obviously started to get some of that after that. Like, I think he has an ASIC sponsor now. There's many more sponsors coming, and there's some real momentum behind him, and he'll be pushing very close to his career high ranking. So it's great to see. And for anybody, hopefully Kim will be listening, but a bit of trivia that she might like, is the first Indian man to beat a seeded player at a Grand Slam since Ramesh Krishan defeated top seed Mats Wilander in Australia in 1989. So it's not the top seed he took out, it's the 31st seed, but it's still a fantastic result. Yeah. And I mean, if anyone's going to be playing very freely, just swinging in the next round, I mean, he's got nothing to lose, everything to gain, and a lot of support.
Well, looking back on day two, the big match that we need to discuss now is Caroline Garcia versus Naomi Osaka. Proper round one popcorn match in the ladies singles competition. Garcia came out with the victory. It was 6-4, 7-6. And what did you make of this? Because, you know, I was looking at collector set predictions, and a lot of people had Naomi Osaka delivering the upset against Caroline Garcia. I will add, not us. But,
never us.
No, we're too good for that. But what did you make of Caroline Garcia's performance against Osaka?
I mean, it was clear from the off when you saw just how well she was serving that she was going to be tough to break, and she really did step up her game. She loves playing on the big stage. And it's kind of the worst draw, I was thinking when I saw this, the worst possible draw for Naomi, because she doesn't get time on the ball, and Garcia can just take all that time away from you, whether it's on the serve or whether it's on the ground strokes. She won't be intimidated by a fast ball from Osaka, and that was the case, really. I saw some great sort of analysis from Andrea Petkovic, who kind of said that the thing that you miss when you return after an injury layoff is that hand-eye coordination. And Naomi really did struggle on return, and she said that she hasn't really got her eye into the return yet. And that's something that does come a little bit later as you come back, because, I mean, it's very tough playing such a great server, especially. But if you look at some of the stats from that match, she didn't generate one break point in that entire match, which is obviously very unlike Naomi Osaka. And she won just 15% of receiving points. She did a great job on her own serve, but if you're not making those opportunities on return, and you're not picking it right, then it's going to be very tough for you to get past a player like Garcia. But positive signs, nevertheless, in terms of what she can do, but it certainly isn't the fairy tale return that she was hoping for.
Yeah, it's been interesting talking around kind of comebacks. It feels like there's been a lot of comebacks at the Australian Open to, you know, mixed success. For example, Raducanu, it looks like that's gone well.
Bit of a different draw, exactly.
But
I'd take Shelby Rogers over Caroline Garcia any day.
Definitely. And the tennis that Garcia played, I mean, I almost want to talk already maybe about I didn't even want to say Grand Slam contender, but honestly, at times, it did feel like the Garcia of old. I mean, she hit 34 winners, 13 aces. I do genuinely think it was flawless at times, and I can't remember too many tennis matches I think she has played a more consistent and better performance in. And I think that is credit to how well Osaka came onto the court after, you know, so many months out, and the level that she brought, that Garcia, she had to be on the top of her game in order to come out with a victory.
Yeah, she did. And if she had kind of dipped a little bit or made a few more unforced errors, then I think it could have been a bit different. I think Naomi did have more unforced errors in that match, which does make it difficult, especially when someone's playing that well. But that's the thing with Garcia. I mean, if the serve is working, then she's very hard to beat. But she does have these patches that we see in matches. I think I said previously that she's almost got a kind of talk about this with Daniela Hentschkova as well. She always had one fantastic set in her each match. But do you have two is the question. And in this one, she did have two. But if she hadn't taken that tie break, you'd have to think that that's the exact sort of match that Garcia, when she's on an off day, would lose to someone like Osaka. So when she gets it done and she's straight through, no thinking, just hitting, then I think she does a fantastic job on a tennis court.
Well, the highest seed from the ladies' draw that did crash out was Wimbledon champion Markéta Vondroušová, who lost to Diana Yastremska. Bit of an odd scoreline, this 6-1, 6-2. I was not expecting this. Was Vondroušová injured? Was she just not at the races? Did Yastremska just pull out a 10 out of 10 performance? I was very surprised by this result.
Yeah, and so was I, because we've seen Vondroušová play some amazing tennis, especially for her country. And I mean, last year at Wimbledon, I mean, she was so assured in how she was playing, and it doesn't really feel like this is a result that makes sense. But if you do look at the fact that Yastremska has come through qualifying, and I do really think that she was fired up for it, and she's someone who, you know, she has been much, much higher in the rankings previously. She has won titles on the tour before, and she did have that dip in form and a period where she was unable to play. But if you look at the stats for this, it doesn't look like Vondroušová played well at all. And I mean, if you look at her, she won 44% of service points on her first serve, which is not good. She only hit 5 winners and 19 unforced errors. And with those sort of stats, it doesn't really matter too much what your opponent is doing. I mean, you're not going to get it done. And you have to think, from a Grand Slam champion, not to be able to raise her level in this sort of situation or ask more questions for someone with such a wonderful skill set she does have, must be disappointing, because she hasn't pushed on in the way that you would have hoped after Wimbledon. And we're in a similar situation that we are so often with individual Grand Slam champions, where it's very hard to back it up, especially the season and the Grand Slams after you've got that result.
Well, that was a very good result for Yastremska. And, you know, another player who, you know, I was had my eye on in the draw, in the men's draw, was Felix Auger-Aliassime, who didn't have a great season last season, got up against Dominic Thiem. You know, these were ultimately two players finding form. And I was just fascinated in terms of, like, who was going to come through this, because I felt like both were going to offer chances and not really take it fully by the horns. And I feel like we got that because it ultimately went down to the, you know, a fifth set. And Auger-Aliassime at the end just said he just felt relief once he won that match. And I can't disagree with him. But at the same time, I feel a bit sad for Dominic Thiem, because I feel like he's always embroiled in these epic 5-set round one matches at Grand Slams and always comes out as the loser.
It's a tough one for him, and another tough loss for him. I mean, they are sort of the two best players at trying not to take their chances at the moment.
Yes,
both really need a win, and it almost felt like you wanted to fast forward and just have a one set shootout to avoid some of the pain of what might be coming beforehand. But I mean, there were flashes of brilliance from team in that match, and for Felix, it's great that he got through it again. I mean, the sad thing about it is that both players really are looking for a win, and when you play for kind of close to 5 hours, it's going to make getting another win even less likely at that point. So it takes it out of you.
A few years ago, this match just would not be in this category of, I was watching it and I just almost felt a little bit sad because we had two players finding form. With Dominic Thiem, I don't even know if that form is ever going to return. I'm obviously a little bit more confident with Ogier Aliassim, but I hope Thiem still gets his moment at a future Grand Slam because he's had some very painful losses over the last year or so at this level and at this stage as well. I mean, another painful loss, Chris, we very quickly need to talk about before we go to a break, is Andy Murray versus Tomas Echeverri. Now, a lot of people, including myself, were maybe getting a bit too ahead of ourselves and thinking, "Oh, Andy Murray, Gael Monfils, round two. Oh, Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic, round three." I mean, maybe that was just solely me.
Might have been, yeah.
Echeverri had... He had completely a different set of plans on the agenda because he wiped the floor with Andy Murray. It was one of Murray's ugliest performances, I would say, in a Grand Slam. 6-4, 6-2, 6-2. You know, Murray walked off. He did a long extended wave. He looked at all of the sides of the court, and it just inevitably broke the conversation of retirement. And I can't argue with it after the display that he put on the tennis court.
Yeah, I think he's been talking a lot about whether he's happy on the court and whether he's enjoying his tennis. And he said at the end of the last season he wasn't really. He still thinks he's playing well on the practice court, but he was very frustrated that he's not able to do it, you know, on the court and in these big matches. And it's just such a strange thing watching Andy Murray not fired up and not giving it everything, especially after last year's performance where he left everything on the court.
Yeah, especially at the Australian Open where he's had repeated, you know, success, you know, getting to finals. We just aren't accustomed to this type of Andy Murray performance in round one.
Without the fight, especially without the fight. Like, Andy Murray is kind of such an inspiration to so many for the way that he fights and the way that he kind of toughs out these matches, triumph against adversity. And it just feels like maybe at this point he might be running out of steam a little bit. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, he's done an incredible thing coming back from his hip surgery. I mean, people thought that he'd retired, that we'd never see him on a court again. And we've had, what is it, nearly 5 more years of Andy Murray playing tennis, which is such a joy for fans and supporters of him. But I think, you know, it's very tough when you aren't and you haven't got back to where you were or where you'd like to be, you know, in the seeds, in contention. And I think here it was just wasn't able to bring it. And the only time I've seen a performance like this was, you know, in 2020 at the French Open, where he went out to Stan Wawrinka, 1-3 and 2. I mean, I think he was wearing like running leggings that day and he didn't do any running. He just really wasn't really like present at that match. He didn't really show up. So it's always worrying when you see that, because if Murray had lost, you know, in an epic 5-set to Echeverri, we'd say like, next time, great draw, here we go. But clearly he is thinking about whether the balance and the payoff and the value exchange is enough. You know, he could be at home with his family. He could hang up his racket and he could live a very fulfilled life there. And if he isn't feeling fulfilled on the tennis court, then you're going to weigh up whether that's the right decision for you or not. And hopefully, I think we're all hoping, right, Joel, that we see him at Wimbledon, he sticks it out for the grass court season, and then we're able to send him off in a proper way if that's what he wants, or keep playing until you're 40. Either way, we'll take it.
Either way, yes. I mean, yeah, it didn't offer me, you know, much optimism the way, you know, he stepped out on court and he was just spraying error after error. Tomas Echeverri is a very tough opponent. You know, they've had some very attritional battles in the past. But as I say, that fight and that character and that grit and determination that we have become so accustomed to, you know, with Andy Murray, particularly in this arena, in Grand Slams, in best of 5-set format, it wasn't there. And I think that's what is the most, you know, worrying sign, because if that happens, he's not happy with himself. And when he's not happy with himself, he might be thinking about hanging up his racket. And we'll have to wait and see what comes. He could turn it around, you know, the tour events, you know, outside of the Grand Slams. He's got time to think, to go back and lick his wounds. But very, very tough defeat. So a little bit disappointing from Murray. Another player, Wawrinka, lost to Mannarino in five sets. We had Kecmanovic come through in four sets. Yeah, some good players coming through despite some tests. Very quickly, Chris, Coco Gauff came through in very easy fashion in her match against Schmiedlova on the Rod Laver Arena, opening up 6-3, 6-love. I think she's going to be champion in 2 weeks' time. I think it's just very exciting that we've got Pegula, Świątek, Gauff, Sabalenka just all having very, very, very solid opening rounds. What did you make of the Gauff performance?
I mean, what a fantastic result after winning the US Open. I think we forget that's the last slam that we've had because it kind of seems like it was a little time ago now. And she put in such a great performance, super confident. She's changed up her serve. She's been working with Andy Roddick in the off-season. And again, I mean, she's just improving and improving. And she's improving that forehand is being struck even better. And she's wearing an outfit that is so reminiscent of Serena Williams. It was actually a year when Serena didn't win the title, though. So a lot of people are making comparisons. But I'm like, maybe you should have picked a different fit. You know, one of the ones from when she won. But yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated to see Coco go deep in a slam again and see if this like new mentality is here to stay, and that maybe she can do something that Vondrousova obviously couldn't, which is, you know, really back up your performance and your results and cement her spot, maybe, you know, break into the top two. I think that would be a real story.
Possible.
And it's possible. It's one to watch.
Well, we shall see, but we're going to take a quick break now. Do join us in the second half where we'll be taking a look back on all the action from day one at Melbourne Park, having a look at day four, plus revealing our collector set player pick predictions. So do not go anywhere.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to the Tennis Weekly podcast. And now we're going to move on to day one, Chris, the historic Sunday start.
We can't remember it.
We still got a late finish, but we did get some very intriguing, matchups. We had Jannik Sinner come through in straight sets against Botic van der Zandschulp. Sakkari, straight set, 6-4, 6-1. Krejcikova coming through in three sets. One match I want to talk about, though, is Novak Djokovic, the top seed, against a qualifier. He was pushed all the way. I think it was the longest ever first-round Grand Slam match he has ever had against Prismic of Croatia. He won in four sets, 6-2, 6-7, 6-3, 6-4. He did admit that he was feeling under the weather, but he didn't want to take that away from the teenager because he put on a show. He put on a fantastic performance. And Djokovic, he was, as I say, that was a very stern test first up.
Yeah, and a real surprise package. I think, again, I mean, it shows, and you can rate this back to the Andy Murray point, that anyone can play such incredible tennis. I mean, obviously, Thomas Martin Echeverri is someone who was seeded, but this player is not seeded at all. This is a qualifier, who's very much an unheard of sort of talent, aged, 18 on the tour and ranked, just inside the world's top 200. And Djokovic described it as, I felt like I was playing myself in a mirror. I mean, that's deeply concerning.
That's the highest compliment I think you can ever get.
Yeah, I mean, it probably is. I mean, if it just said it was just like looking in a mirror, you might be like, well, I mean, that's a bit of an odd one. But playing like, I mean, it did look like that if you were watching them go toe-to-toe. And we do always say Djokovic loves to lose a set in the early rounds. We've seen it before. We've seen it with Draper. Mm. We've seen it with, I think, Carl Edmonds taking a set off him. I think it was another American has taken a set off him. And I think that was
he wouldn't have liked though the fact that round one went 4 hours and 1 minute. I know we talk about it as say kind of dropping a token set, but already that length of time on the tennis court, that is that's not as, even regardless of who you are, that's not a situation you want to be in, especially if you're under the weather.
Yes, especially if you're under the weather, or especially if you're Sabalenka and playing after that match. but no, I think you don't want it to go too long. I think the only positive from that would be that he'll know how his wrist is after that. Mm. And clearly, I think it's doing okay if you're able to get through that sort of a match. But he'll be hoping that he'll have some shorter ones coming up. But I think we've seen it so many times. I'm not concerned about Djokovic's level, because we've seen him improve and improve and improve as the tournament goes on, to almost kind of defeat like the world number two in straight sets in the end. So I think it's a less than ideal start. But I mean, if you followed Djokovic's career, you'll know that anything like this he can rebound from. And it seems like as he gets older, he finds it even easier to rebound from it. But I would say, kind of on a slightly different note, I mean, it was the first match we saw from Jannik Sinner this year. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I think it was impressive given the caliber of opponent that he was up against in Van der Zandschulp. He's gone deep before, you know, at a Grand Slam. But I think, you know, to get the job done in straight sets as a top eight seed with expectation, I think that was impressive given, as I say, I think the general theme looking at the top seeds in the men's draw is that it's not been easy, you know, for the favourites. It's been really testing at times. And I do wonder if the slowness of the courts, the balls,
yeah,
whether it is a leveller and these players who, you know, you might not have never heard of them and you might think there's a massive gap between them. I wonder if these conditions and all this thing is coming into play and is actually closing the gap, and you're having these long rallies and it's bringing these opponents closer to the top ranked guys. So from that perspective, I think Jannik Sinner will be very happy that he was able to get it, you know, job done, 2.5 hours on the court, off the court. Especially, I think, given, you know, I watched a bit of Carlos Alcaraz against Richard Gasquet. I think there was a little bit of rust there in that first set. Gasquet could have very easily taken that opening set tiebreak. And I would say with Jannik Sinner, I didn't see as much rust, I think, given it was his, you know, his opening match of the season, competitive match of the season.
So maybe my prediction of Sinner isn't looking quite so idiotic as Ben Rothenberg referred to it on the podcast when I spoke to him. But maybe that's got something to do with some of the retirements we've seen. We've seen quite a few high-profile retirements. The Medvedev match ended in retirement. Rajanic, you know, after he did go up a set and then they went to one set.
That was so sad.
That was gutting.
I was watching that and I'm like, I know Raonic is like a gust of wind, I feel, could injure him or blow him over at the moment. But he was playing such good tennis against Dimonor, really causing him, you know, problems. But at the same time, that in that second set, I was watching it, he just looked gassed. He just looked out of energy. He just looked a little bit uncomfortable. And I was like, there is absolutely no way he is going to be able to keep up with the conditioning of someone like a Dimonor, regardless of the obvious ability that he has in his hands.
I mean, is this the marathon tournament where it's not a sprint? It certainly seems like it's going to take a long time, and you've got to be prepared for that.
To me, it's already taking too long. Like, I'm worried that these matches, the amount that's being spent. I mean, a guy's just vomited on the tennis court, Jack Draper. I'm a little bit worried in terms of, is this going to be the tournament where we're going to be talking about pushing health and conditioning like further than it's ever been before? Maybe. I mean, I've been hearing that the temperatures are going to get even hotter, you know, towards the end of this week as well. So it's not going to get any easier, I don't think.
Well, I mean, this is the sort of thing. Will this be the straw that breaks the camel's back when it comes to the balls, when it comes to the speed of the courts, when it comes to some of the heat rules they might have as well, because it's almost the perfect storm when it comes to these balls getting very fluffed up and getting very heavy. I mean, I think I saw Mike Dixon refer to it as like, it's like grapefruits they're playing with, which I thought was a fantastic sort of description, because it does make you realize that just how much difference there is between the balls they play in these tournaments. And I mean, it's very sad when you see players have to retire. We're not sure it's connected. I mean, obviously last year's semi-finalist Magdalena Net had to pull out against Caroline Wozniacki, which is a really big shame, because that could have been a very good contest if they're both able to play at their highest level. But I mean, are you okay after that result, Joel? I know that you love GoatNet, but...
I know, I did have to adjust to it. But yeah, nice to see Caroline Wozniacki put her victory. You know, I say Rublev and Fritz, they had to come through very tight five-set
battles.
They
made it look difficult, didn't they?
It just, yeah. And I don't know if it's that, if it's them. It is, you know, it is down to them a little bit. But I do feel like there's something else at play here, potentially.
Yeah, there's definitely something. There's something at work, because when you look at like the fact that, I mean, obviously, Seabreeze Wilde has had like some good results at Slams. You know, he did have that kind of stunning upset with Medvedev. So he does like the big stage. So I guess maybe people who see that result might be very, very surprised by it against Rublev. But at the same time, you know, he does like to play in these matches, and you can see how that could happen. But you think with Fritz, though, I mean, come on, Taylor Fritz, you've got to start winning some of these matches a bit easier, because he always has a good draw, like at last year's
Diaz
US Open.
Diaz Acosta. Yeah, like that to me just shouldn't be lasting more than 4 hours. But they came through, and yeah, I mean, one country actually that did very well, I saw Italy, 6 out of 6 in the men's singles, and Arnaldi won. I think he's going to be a very dangerous player in the second round. Timofeeva as well in the ladies competition. She could be, you know, I'm quite interested. She had a very easy win over Elise Cornet, the wild card. So
what about Linda?
Results.
We haven't mentioned Linda, have we?
We hang on. Is this Linda Frivertova or Linda Noskova?
Frivertova, your pick. Both.
Well, yes. I'm still actually not sure who I meant. Did I mean Linda Frivertova, or did I mean Brenda Frivertova?
Or
I mean both? Or did I mean Linda Noskova?
Some of our listeners did think you meant Brenda. And so I think maybe that can be forgiven, because Brenda did do a little bit better in the sense that she won her first round and will play against Sabalenka in the next round. So I will give you a nod there. It was the wrong Frivertova.
It was the wrong.
Still, a Frivertovist in the draw.
A Frivertova is still in the draw. Got Sabalenka next. Yeah, little fact about Frivertova, actually. Her and Korneva, they both won in round one. First time 2 16-year-olds, Chris, have won in a women's singles round of 128 at a Grand Slam since Wimbledon 2007. I know you're a massive WTA aficionado. Can you tell me who those 2 16-year-olds were at Wimbledon 2007?
Round two. Okay, so they don't have to go on too long a run. Is it going to be someone super random like Cecil Karatancheva? I have no
idea.
That
feels too random. Well, the answer is there's one actually, a player actually we've just mentioned, Caroline Wozniacki, and Tamira Paschek.
She could really slap the ball from Austria. She really was a talent. Quarterfinal at the French Open, I believe. I think she's still playing. So, but on the slightly lower level of the tour, she played in a Fed Cup match recently. So,
well, there you go. Well, I mean, one other teenager who I'm very excited to see in day four is Mira Andreeva, who has Ons Jabeur first up on Rod Laver Arena. That is our nighttime in the UK tonight. A lot of people have this one on upset alert. How are you feeling about how are you feeling about the rest of the schedule on day four?
I am willing with all my might, Ons, to defeat Andreeva, because I believe she was in your predictions.
Here we go.
Both of you and Kim had her in the quarterfinals. So I'm very single-minded here that Ons is going to straight sets this result. Andreeva said that Ons is one of her idols and she wants to play tennis like Ons. She compares her game to that of Ons. But for me, even though Ons has only played one match this year and it was the first round, I thought she looked pretty good. So I'm predicting a straight sets result there. I think that there could be some good matches, though. I think there aren't necessarily like the firework. We had some better first round matches, if I'm honest, with some of the draws did lend itself to some pretty crazy matches. And if you're looking at this, you'd have to say that, you know, the Djokovic Popperin is going to be very entertaining, and Arnaldi Diminar is like playing a version of yourself. So they probably, I'd say the men's matches have my attention. And then if I'm looking at some of the outside courts, we do have some great matches like Monfils versus Echeverri. I mean, we talked about both of them. I think that's a great ticket. I think that would be a really great contest and hopefully a bit more, a bit closer than Echeverri's first round match. But are you looking in the same places as me, or is there a teenager somewhere else you're watching?
I think so. I mean, I'm also curious about Leila Fernandez. You like.
Oh, yeah, Leila Fernandez.
Fernandez against Alicia Parks. You've got Fritz versus Gaston as well. I think that could be quite entertaining.
Tsitsipas, we have to mention, did you see the over-the-net shot?
Oh, yes,
it was amazing. And everyone was saying, oh, are you allowed to do that? Well, it was because...
there was so much backspin, wasn't there?
Yes, that it went onto
the other side.
Yeah.
And then you think that's the end of the highlight reel. And then
spun around, just managed to keep his balance. And I mean, people are saying shot of the year, shot of the tournament. And anyone who hasn't seen it, I mean, it is. That's why you do your yoga.
Hang on, so, I thought he was injured.
Maybe into something else, but he made that look very easy. And I mean, based on the fact that he's playing against Jordan Thompson, that's going to be quite interesting because he's an unknown quantity, really, in terms of his ability at the moment. But his shot making, well, that's there to stay based on the highlights reel.
Before we finish up this episode, we're going to move on to Collector Set. And we're going to be unveiling Joel and Chris's player pick predictions. In our last episode, we unveiled our six players. They were Grigor Dimitrov, Jack Draper, Alex de Minaur, Naomi Osaka, Emma Raducanu and Elena Svitolina. First of all, thank you everyone who has entered. We actually think it's a record number of entrants into this year's collector set.
That's so not good. There's no way that we're going to do well.
No, it's not. It's not at all. Well, we are now going to unveil Joel and Chris's player pick predictions. Chris, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say the player and we're going to take it in turns and say what round we think they're going to make.
Can I ask you a question first, Joel? Did you stick with your quarter finalist predictions or did you go a bit rogue? Because I used to do the go a bit rogue and cover my both bases.
Because of the Sunday start, I've actually already forgotten, I think.
Okay, well, we don't know, but we know what you have here in front of you.
I can't remember. But right, okay, let's go. But let's go for it. Grigor Dimitrov.
Fourth round.
I've gone fourth round as well.
Fantastic prediction, Joel.
Jack Draper.
I stuck with my guns. I think I have to. I said semi-final.
Wow. Okay. Round three. Alex de Minaur.
This is a big point of contention. You think he's going to go out to Rublev. I think he's making the quarterfinal.
Yes, I think that. Round four. I've got round four. Okay. Here we go. Naomi Osaka. What did we put?
Well, we both put round one, but it was very tricky because Kim didn't. Just spoiler alert for when she unveils her predictions. But Kim wanted Garcia to win and I wanted Naomi to win. So at least there's a consolation prize for both of us that despite Naomi losing, we do get a point on collector set.
Yes.
And has this ever happened
before? We're up on Kim.
We've never had a point before we've announced them. So, I mean, we'll take that.
Well, okay. What about the next player? Emma Raducanu.
I went fourth round.
Ooh. I've gone round two. I've got her going out in her next match.
Oh, wow. I think you were thinking Chris Dea would be playing against her, maybe.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Okay, I'm not sure about that one. And finally, Elena Svitolina.
Well, we haven't talked about her yet, but I still have her to win. So, yeah.
I'm just looking at this on the script. I actually thought that was a typo.
No. I've put her to win on everything. So it's on our socials. I've committed to it. I've said,
okay,
I'm going to stand by my guns. What did you go for?
I went very safe and I just said round four.
So losing to ego, is that?
Yeah.
Probably.
There's a lot of, I think just generally seeing everyone's responses, a lot of round four a lot of round four picks for a lot of these players. So it'll be quite interesting, I think, when we get to that middle stage, who is there and who is not.
In fact, Joel, you've not predicted anyone to reach a quarterfinal out of that lot. Mm. Out of Dimitrov, Draper, Dimonar, Raducanu, Svitolina,
we've got zero quarterfinalists. That doesn't sound right, does it? Well,
doesn't sound
right. By the end of week one. Well, we're going to leave it there, listeners. I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action to come over the next couple of weeks from the Australian Open. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You can also follow us on social media or email the show. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube at Tennis Weekly Pod. Purchase Tennis Weekly merch at etsy.com/shop/tennisweeklypodcast. You can email the show tennisweeklypod@gmail.com or check out our website tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we are going to be back on Thursday at Tennis Weekly HQ for our round two AO catch up. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.